God damn it! Look here! He began, but by that time I had sneaked out the door and had closed it softly behind me. But Tom's accident wasn't all that happened that winter. There was Ann Stanton's project of getting state money for the children's home. She got a good handout and was pleased as punch with herself. She claimed she was about to get a 2-year grant, which was badly needed, she said, and was probably right, for the springs of private charity had nigh dried up about 1929, and weren't running more than a trickle even 7 years or so later. There were stirrings down in the 4th District, where McMurphy still had things by the short ones. His representative got up in Congress in Washington, which was far off, but not as far off as the moon, and aired his views about the boss and made headlines over the country. So the boss bought himself a big wad of radio time and aired his views of Congressman Pettit and treated the nation to a detailed biography in several installments of Congressman Pettit, who it developed from the work of the boss's research department, had thrown a grenade in a glass house. The boss didn't answer anything Pettit had said. He simply took care of the sayer. The boss knew all about the so-called fallacy of the argumentum ad hominem. It may be a fallacy, he said, but it is sure God useful. If you use the right kind of argumentum, you can always scare the hominem into a laundry bill he didn't expect. Pettit didn't come off too well, but you had to hand it to McMurphy. He never quit trying. Tiny Duffy didn't quit trying either. He was hell-bent on selling the boss on the idea of throwing the basic contract for the hospital to Gummy Larson, who was a power in the 4th District and would no doubt persuade McMurphy, or, to speak more plainly, would sell him out. The boss would listen to Tiny about as attentively as he listened to rain on the roof and say, "Sure, Tiny, sure, we'll talk about it sometime," or, "God damn it, Tiny, change your record." Or he might say nothing in reply, but would look at Tiny in a massive, deep-eyed, detached, calculating way, as though he were measuring him for something, and not say a word, till Tiny's voice would trail off into a silence so absolute you could hear both men's breathing, Tiny's breath sibilant, quick, and shallow for all his bulk, and the boss's steady and deep. The boss, meanwhile, was making that hospital his chief waking thought. He took trips up east to see all the finest, biggest ones, the Massachusetts General, the Presbyterian in New York, the Philadelphia General, and a lot more. "By God," he would say, "I don't care how fine they are, mine's going to be finer, and I don't care how big they are, mine's going to be bigger, and any poor bugger in this state can go there and get the best there is and not cost him a dime." When he was off on his trips, he spent his time with doctors and architects and hospital superintendents, and never a torch singer or a bookmaker. And when he was back home, his office was nothing but a pile of blueprints and notebooks full of his scribblings and books on architecture and heating systems and dietetics and hospital management. You would come in and he would look up at you and begin talking, right in the middle of a beat, as though you had been there all the time. "Now, up at the Massachusetts General, they've got..." It was his baby, all right. But Tiny wouldn't give up. One night I came into the mansion, saw Sugar Boy, who was lounging in the high, chastely proportioned hall with a sheet of newspaper across his knee, a dismantled .38 in his hand, and a can of gun oil on the floor. Asked him where the boss was, watched him while his lips tortured themselves to speak and the spit flew, realized from the jerk of his head that the boss was back in the library, and went on back to knock on the big door. As soon as I opened the door, I ran right into the boss's eyes, like running into the business end of a double-barreled 10-gauge shotgun at 3 paces, and halted. "Look," he commanded, heaving his bulk up erect on the big leather couch where he had been propped. "Look." And he swung the double barrel round to cover Tiny, who stood at the hearthrug before him and seemed to be melting the tallow down faster than even the log fire on the bricks would have warranted. "Look," he said to me. "This bastard tried to trick me. Tried to smuggle that Gummy Larson in here to talk to me. Gets him all the way up here from Dubois-ville and thinks I'll be polite." But the hell I was polite. He swung to Tiny again. Was I polite? Tiny didn't manage to utter a sound. "Was I, goddammit?" the boss demanded. "No," Tiny said as from the bottom of a deep well. "I was not," the boss said. I didn't let him get across that door sill. He pointed at the closed door beyond me. I told him if I ever wanted to see him, I'd send for him and to get the hell out. But you... And he snapped out a forefinger at Tiny. You... I thought... You thought you'd trick me. Trick me into buying him. Well, I'm not buying him. I'm gonna bust him. I bought too many sons of bitches already. Bust them and they'll stay busted, but buy them and you can't tell how long they'll stay bought. I bought too many already. I made a mistake not busting you, but I figured you'd stay bought. You're scared not to. Now, boss, Tiny said, now, boss, that ain't fair. You know how all us boys feel about you and all. It ain't being scared, it's... You damn well better be scared, the boss said, and his voice was suddenly sweet and low, like a mother whispering to her child in the crib. But there was new sweat on Tiny. Now get out, the boss said in a more positive tone. I looked at the door after it had been closed upon the retreating form and said, You certainly do woo your constituency. Christ, he said, and sank back on the leather of the couch and shoved some of the blueprints aside. He reached up and tried to unbutton his collar, fumbled, got impatient and snapped off the button and jerked the tie loose. He twisted his heavy head a little from side to side as though the collar had been choking him. Christ, he said almost pettishly. Can't he understand I don't want him messing around with this thing? And he shoved at the blueprints again. What do you expect? I asked. There's $6 million involved. Did you ever see the flies stay away from the churn at churning time? He better stay away from this churn. He's just being logical. Obviously, Larson is ready to sell out McMurphy for a contract. He is a competent builder. He lunged up to a sitting position, stared at me, and demanded, Are you in on this? It's nothing to me, I said, and shrugged. You can build it with your bare hands for all of me. I merely said that given his premises, Tiny's logical. Can't you understand? He demanded, searching my face. Damn it, can't you understand either? I understand what I understand. Can't you understand? He demanded and heaved up from the couch, and the instant he was on his feet, from the slight sway of his posture, I knew he'd been drinking. He stepped to me and seized my lapel and shook me a little, fixing his eyes upon my face. Now close to him, I could see that they were bloodshot, and saying, Can't you understand either? I'm building that place, the best in the country, the best in the world, and a bugger like Tiny's not going to mess with it. And I'm going to call it the Willie Stark Hospital, and it'll be there a long time after I'm dead and gone, and you are dead and gone, and all those sons of bitches are dead and gone, and anybody, no matter he hasn't got a dime, can go there, and we'll vote for you, I said. I'll be dead, he said, and you'll be dead, and I don't care whether he votes for me or not. He can go there and... And bless your name, I said. Damn it! He shook me hard, crumpling my lapel in his big hand. You stand there grinning like that. Get that grin off your face. Get it off, or I'll... Listen, I said. I'm not any of your scum, and I'm still grinning when I please. Jack? Hell, Jack... You know I don't mean that. It's just you stand there and grin. Damn it, can't you understand, can't you? He held the lapel and thrust the big face at me, his eyes gouging into mine, saying, Can't you? Can't you see I'm not going to let those bastards muck with it? The Willie Stark Hospital, can't you see? And I'm going to get me the damn best man there is to run it. Yes, sir, the best there is. Yes, sir, up in New York, they told me to get him. He was the man. And Jack, you... Yeah? I asked. You're gonna get him. I disengaged myself from the grasp on my lapel, straightened it, and dropped into a chair. Get who? I asked. Dr. Stanton, he said. Dr. Adam Stanton. I almost bounced right out of the chair. The ash off my cigarette fell down my shirt front. How long have you been having these symptoms? I asked. You been seeing any pink elephants? You get Stanton, he said. You are hearing voices, I said. You get him, he repeated dourly. Boss, I said, Adam is an old pal of mine. I know him like a brother, and I know he hates your guts. I'm not asking him to love me. I'm asking him to run my hospital. I'm not asking anybody to love me, not even you. We all love you, I mimicked Tiny. You know how all us boys feel. Get him, he said. I stood up, stretched, yawned, moved toward the door. I am leaving, I declared. Tomorrow, when you are in possession of your faculties, I'll hear what you've got to say. And I shut the door behind me. Tomorrow, when he was in full possession of his faculties, I heard what he had to say, and it was, get Stanton. So I went to the shabby little monastic apartment where the grand piano glittered like a sneer in the midst of near squalor, and the books and papers piled on chairs, and the old coffee cup with dried dregs inside, which the colored girl had forgotten to pick up, and where the friend of my youth received me as though he were not a success, and I were not a failure, both spelled with capital letters, laid his hand on my shoulder, pronounced my name, looked at me from the ice-water blue abstract eyes, which were a reproach to all uncertain, twisted, and clouded things, and were as unwavering as conscience. But the smile on his face, unsealing almost tentatively the firm suture of the mouth, put a warmth in you, a shy warmth like you discover with surprise in the winter sunshine in late February. That smile was his apology for being what he was, for looking at you the way he did, for seeing what he saw. It did not so much forgive you and the world as ask forgiveness for himself for the crime of looking straight at whatever was before him, which might be you. But he didn't smile often. He smiled at me not because I was what I was, but because I was the friend of his youth. The friend of your youth is the only friend you will ever have, for he does not really see you. He sees in his mind a face which does not exist anymore, speaks a name, Spike, Bud, Snip, Red, Rusty, Jack, Dave, which belongs to that now non-existent face, but which by some inane and doddering confusion of the universe is for the moment attached to a not too happily met and boring stranger. But he humors the drooling, doddering confusion of the universe, and continues to address politely that dull stranger by the name which properly belongs to the boy face and to the time when the boy voice called thinly across the late afternoon water or murmured by a campfire at night or in the middle of a crowded street said, "Gee, listen to this. On Wenlock Edge the wood's in trouble. His forest fleece the reckon heaves." The friend of your youth is your friend because he does not see you anymore. And perhaps he never saw you. What he saw was simply part of the furniture of the wonderful opening world. Friendship was something he suddenly discovered and had to give away as a recognition of and payment for the breathlessly opening world which momently divulged itself like a moonflower. It didn't matter a damn to whom he gave it, for the fact of giving was what mattered. And if you happened to be handy, you were automatically endowed with all the appropriate attributes of a friend, and forever after your reality is irrelevant. The friend of your youth is the only friend you will ever have, for he hasn't the slightest concern with calculating his interest or your virtue. He doesn't give a damn, for the moment, about getting ahead or needs must admiring the best, the two official criteria in adult friendships. And when the boring stranger appears, he puts out his hand and smiles, not really seeing your face, and speaks your name, which doesn't really belong to your face, saying, "Well, Jack, damn glad you came. Come on in, boy." So I sat in one of his broken-down easy chairs, after he had cleared the books out, and drank his whiskey, and waited for the moment when I was going to say, "Now listen here, I'm going to tell you something, and don't you start yelling till I finish." He didn't yell till I had finished. Not that I took long to finish. I said, "Governor Stark wants you to be director of the new hospital and medical center." He didn't, to be precise, yell then. He didn't make a sound. He looked at me for nearly a minute with an unsmiling clinical eye as though my symptoms merited special attention. Then he slowly shook his head. "Better think it over," I said. "Maybe it's not as bad as it sounds. There may be some angles." but I let my voice trail off, watching him shake his head again and smile now, with the smile which did not forgive me but humbly asked me to forgive him for not being like me, for not being like everybody else, for not being like the world. If he had not smiled. If he had smiled, but had smiled a confident, to hell with you, satirical smile, or even a smile forgiving me. If he had not smiled the smile which humbly, but with dignity, begged me to forgive him, then things might have been different. But he smiled that way, out of the fullness of whatever it was he had, out of the depth of the idea he lived by, whatever the hell it was, or why ever the hell he lived that way. And things were the way they turned out to be. Giving that smile, he was like a man who stops to give a beggar a buck, and in opening his wallet lets the beggar catch sight of the big roll. If the beggar hadn't seen the big roll, he would never have followed the man down the street, waiting for the block without the street lamp. Not so much because he wants the roll, as because he now cannot endure the man who has it, and gave him a buck. For as he smiled and said, "But I'm not interested in the angles," I did not feel that shy warmth as of the winter sunshine which I had always felt before when he smiled, but suddenly felt something else, which I didn't have a name for, but which was like the winter itself and not the winter sunshine, like the stab of an icicle through the heart. And I thought, "All right, you smile like that. You smile like that." So even as the thought vanished, if a thought can ever be said to vanish, for it rises out of you and sinks back into you, so I said, "But you don't know what the angles are. For instance, the boss expects you to write your ticket." "The boss," he repeated. And on the word his upper lip curled more than customary to expose the teeth, and the sibilance seemed exaggerated. "Need not expect to buy me. I have," he looked about the room at the clutter and near squalor, "everything I want." "The boss isn't any fool. You don't think he was trying to buy you?" "He couldn't," he said. "What do you think he was trying to do?" "Threaten me? That would be next." "No," I nodded, "not that. He couldn't scare you." "That is what he seems to depend on, the bribe or the threat." "Guess again," I said. He rose from his chair, took a couple of restless paces across the frayed green carpet, then swung to face me. "He needn't think he can flatter me," he said fiercely. "Nobody could flatter you," I said softly. "Nobody in the world, and do you know why?"
"Why?"
"Listen, pal. There was a man named Dante who said that the truly proud man who knew his own worth could never commit the sin of envy, for he could believe that there was no one for him to envy. He might just as well have said that the proud man who knew his own worth would not be susceptible to flattery, for he would believe that there was nothing anybody else could tell him about his own worth he didn't know already. Now, you couldn't be flattered."
"Not by him, anyway," Adam said grimly.
"Not by anybody," I said, "and he knows it."
"What does he try for, then? Does he think I..."
"Guess again," I said. He stood there in the middle of the frayed green carpet and stared at me, head slightly lowered, with the slightest shade, not of doubt or perturbation, over the fine abstract blue of the eyes. It was just the shade of question, of puzzlement. "But that's something. Not much, but something. It's not the left to the jaw, and it does not rock them on their heels. It doesn't make the breath come sharp. It's just the tap on the nose, the scrape across with the rough heel of the glove. Nothing lethal, just a moment's pause. But it's an advantage. Push it." So I repeated, "Guess again." He did not answer, looking at me with the shade deeper, like a cloud passing suddenly over blue water. "All right," I said, "I'll tell you. He knows you're the best around, but you don't cash in on it. So obviously you don't want money, or you'd charge folks something like the others in the trade, or would hang on to what you do take. You don't want fun, or you'd get some, for you're famous, relatively young, and not crippled. You don't want comfort, or you'd quit working yourself like a navvy and wouldn't live in this slum.
but he knows what you want.
I don't want anything he can give me,
Adam affirmed. Are you sure, Adam? I said, are you sure?
Damn it,
he began, and the blood was up in his cheeks. He knows what you want, I cut in. I can put it in a word, Adam.
What?
You want to do good, I said. That stopped him. His mouth was open like a fish's gaping for air. Sure, I said, that's it. He knows your secret.
I don't see what,
he began fiercely again, but I cut in, saying, easy now, it's no disgrace. It's just eccentric. That you can't see somebody sick without having to put your hands on him. That you can't see somebody with something broken without wanting to fix it. Somebody with something rotten inside him without wanting to take a knife in your strong, white, and damned well-educated fingers, pal, and cut it out. It's merely eccentric, pal. Or maybe it's a kind of super sickness you've got yourself.
There's a hell of a lot of sick people, he said glumly, but I don't see...
Pain is evil, I said cheerfully.
Pain is an evil, he said. But it's not evil. It's not evil in itself.
And took a step toward me, looking at me like an enemy. That's the kind of question I don't debate when I've got the toothache, I retorted. But the fact remains that you are the way you are. And the boss, I delicately emphasized the word boss, knows it. He knows what you want. He knows your weakness, pal. You want to do good, and he's going to let you do good in wholesale lots.
Good, he said wolfishly and twisted his long, thin upper lip. Good. That's a hell of a word to use around where he is.
Is it? I asked casually.
A thing does not grow except in its proper climate, and you know what kind of a climate that man creates, or ought to know.
I shrugged. A thing is good in itself, if it's good. A guy gets ants in his pants and writes a sonnet. Is a sonnet less of a good, if it is good, which I doubt, because the dame he got the ants over happened to be married to somebody else, so that his passion, as they say, was illicit? Is the rose less of a rose because...
You are completely irrelevant, he said.
So I'm irrelevant, I said, and got out of the chair. That's what you always used to say when I got you in a corner in an argument 1,000 years ago, when we were boys and argued all night. Could a first-class boxer whip a first-class wrestler? Could a lion whip a tiger? Is Keats better than Shelley? The good, the true, and the beautiful. Is there a God? We argued all night, and I always won. But you bastard, and I slapped him on the shoulder, you always said I was irrelevant. But little Jackie is never irrelevant, nor is he immaterial, and, I looked around, scooped up my hat and coat, I'm going to leave you with that thought, and...
A hell of a thought it is, he said, but he was grinning now.
He was my pal now. He was the friend of my youth. But I ignored him anyway, saying, You can't say I don't put the cards on the table, me and the boss, but I'm hauling out, for I catch the midnight to Memphis where I am going to interview a medium.
A medium? He echoed.
An accomplished medium named Miss Littlepaw, and she's going to give me word from the other shore that the boss's hospital is going to have a dark, handsome, famous son-of-a-bitch of a director named Stanton. And with that, I slammed his door and was running and stumbling down the dark stairs. For it was the kind of apartment house where the bulb burns out and nobody ever puts a new one in, and there's always a kiddie car left on a landing, and the carpet is worn to ribbons, and the air smells dankly of dogs, diapers, cabbage, old women, burnt grease, and the eternal fate of man. I stood in the dark street and looked back at the building. The shade of a window was up, and I looked in where a heavy, bald man in shirt sleeves sat at a table in what is called a dinette and slumped above a plate like a sack propped in a chair, while a child stood at his elbow, plucking at him, and a woman in a slack, colorless dress and hair stringing down brought a steaming saucepan from the stove, for Papa had come home late as usual with his bunion hurting, and the rent was past due, and Johnny needed shoes, and Susie's report card wasn't any good, and Susie stood at his elbow, plucking at him feebly, and staring at him with her imbecilic eyes and breathing through her adenoids. And the Maxfield Parrish picture was askew on the wall,
with its blues all having the savage tint of copper sulfate in the glaring light from the unshaded bulb hanging from the ceiling. And somewhere else in the building a dog barked. Somewhere else a baby was crying in automatic gasps. And that was life, and Adam Stanton lived in the middle of it, as close as he could get to it. He snuggled up to life, breathing the cabbage smell, stumbling on the kiddie car, bowing to the young, just-married, gum-chewing, hand-holding couple in the hall, hearing through the thin partition the sounds made by the old woman who would be dead—it was cancer, he had told me—before summer, pacing the frayed green carpet among the books and broken-down chairs. He snuggled up to life, to keep warm, perhaps, for he didn't have any life of his own, just the office, the knife, the monastic room. Or perhaps he didn't snuggle to keep warm. Perhaps he leaned over life with his hand on the pulse, watching from the deep-set, abstract, blue clinical eyes, slightly shadowed, leaning ready to pop in the pill, pour the potion, apply the knife. Perhaps he had to be close in order to keep a reason for the things he did, to make the things he did be themselves life, and not merely a delightful exercise of technical skill which man had been able to achieve because he, of all the animals, had a fine thumb. Which is nonsense, for whatever you live is life. That's something to remember when you meet the old classmate who says, "Well, now on our last expedition up the Congo," or the one who says, "Gee, I got the sweetest little wife and three of the swellest kids ever." You must remember it when you sit in hotel lobbies, or lean over bars to talk to the bartender, or stand in a dark street at night in early March and stare into a lighted window. And remember, little Susie in there has adenoids, and the bread is probably burned. And turn up the street, for the time has come to hand me down that walking cane, for I got to catch that midnight train, for all my sin is taken away. For whatever you live is life. As I turned away, there was the wild burst of music from up in the building, louder than the baby's crying, shaking the mortar out of the old brickwork. It was Adam's piano. I caught the train from Memphis, stayed 3 days, had my seance with Miss Littlepaw, and returned, with some photostats and an affidavit in my briefcase. Upon my return, I found the call in my box. It was Anne's number, then Anne's voice on the wire, and as always, the little leap and plunk in my heart, like a frog jumping into a lily pool, with the ripples spreading round. It was her voice saying she had to see me. I told her that was easy, she could see me all the rest of her life. But she ignored that little joke, as no doubt it deserved, and said for me to meet her right away. "At the Crescent Cove," I suggested, and she agreed. The Crescent Cove was Slade's place. I was there first and had a drink with Slade himself in the midst of soft lights and sweet music and the gleam of chromium, and looked at Slade's yellow ivory bullet head and expensive tailoring, and at the reigning blonde at the cash register, and remembered wistfully the morning long ago in Prohibition, when in the back room of his fly-bitten speakeasy, Slade, with hair on his head then and not a dime in his pocket, had refused to fall in with Duffy's attempt to force beer on Cousin Willie from the country, who was, it turned out, Willie Stark, and who wanted orange pop. That had fixed Slade up forever. So now I had my drink, and looking at him, marveled how little is required for a man to be lost or saved. And I looked up into the mirror of the bar and saw Anne Stanton come in the door. Or rather, her image come through the image of the door. For the moment I did not turn to face the reality. Instead, I looked at the image which hung there in the glass like a recollection caught in the ice of the mind. You have seen, in winter in the clear ice of a frozen stream, some clean, bright, golden-red leaf, embedded, to make you think suddenly of the time when all the bright golden-red leaves had been on the trees like a party, and the sunshine had poured down over them as though it would never stop. But it wasn't a recollection, it was Anne Stanton herself, who stood there in the cool room of the looking-glass, above the bar barricade of bright bottles and siphons, across some distance of blue carpet. A girl—well, not exactly a girl anymore, A young woman about 5'4", with the trimmest pair of nervous ankles and smallish hips, which, however, looked as round as though they had been turned on a lathe, and a waist just the width to make you wonder if you could span it with your hand. And all of this done up in a swatch of gray flannel, which pretended to a severe mannish cut, but actually did nothing but scream for attention to some very unmannish arrangements within. She was standing there, not quite ready to start patting the blue carpet with an impatient toe, turning her smooth, cool face, under a light blue felt hat, slowly from one side to the other to survey the room. I caught the flash of blue in her eyes as she glanced about. Then she spotted my back by the bar and came my way. I didn't look around and did not meet her eyes in the mirror. When she was just behind me, she said, "Jack?" I didn't look round. "Slade," I said, "this strange woman keeps following me around, and I thought you ran a respectable place. What the hell are you going to do about it?" Slade had swung round to look at the strange woman, whose face was all at once chalk white and whose eyes were uttering sparks like a couple of arc lights. "Lady," Slade said, "now look here, lady." Then the lady suddenly overcame the paralysis which had frozen her tongue and the blood hit her cheeks. "Jack Burton," she said, "if you don't..." "She knows your name," Slade said. I turned around to face the reality, which was not something caught in the ice of the mind, but was something now flushed, feline, lethal, and electric, and about to blow a fuse. "Well, I declare," I said, "if it isn't my fiancée. Say, Slade, I want you to meet Ann Stanton. We're going to get married." "Gee," Slade said, his pan as dead as something in the sink next morning. "I'm glad to..." "We're getting married in 2150," I said. "It'll be a June wedding with..." "It'll be a March murder," Ann said, "right now." Then she smiled, and the blood subsided in her cheeks, and she put out her hand to Slade. "Glad to meet you," Slade said, and though the face which he exhibited might well have belonged to a wooden Indian, the eyes in it didn't miss any of the details suggested by the coat suit. "How about a drink?" he asked. "Thank you," Anne said, and settled on a martini. After the drink, she said, "Jack, we've got to go." Thanks, Slade, again, and led me away into the night full of neon lights, gasoline fumes, the odor of roasted coffee, and the honk of taxis. "You have a wonderful sense of humor," she said. "Where are we going?" I sidestepped her remark. "You're such a smart aleck." "Where are we going? Aren't you ever going to grow up? Where are we going?" We were walking aimlessly down the side street, past the swinging doors of bars and oyster joints, and past newsstands and old women selling flowers. I bought some gardenias, gave them to her, and said, "I reckon I am a smart aleck, but it's just a way to pass the time." We walked on another half block, threading through the crowd that drifted and eddied in and out of the swinging doors. "Where are we going?"
"I wouldn't be going anywhere with you," she said, "if I didn't have to talk to you."
We were passing another old woman selling flowers, so I took another bunch of gardenias, laid down my four bits, and shoved the blossoms at Ann Stanton. "If you can't be civil," I said, "I'm going to smother you in these damn things."
"All right," she said and laughed. "All right, I'll be good."
And she swung onto my arm and matched her step to mine, holding the flowers in her free hand, her bag tucked under the off elbow. We kept step, not talking, for a half block. I looked down, watching her feet flick out, 1-2, 1-2. She was wearing black suede shoes, very severe, very mannish, and she clicked the pavement with authority, but they were small and the fine ankles flickered, 1-2, 1-2, hypnotically. Then I said, "Where are we going?"
"To walk," she said, "just walk. I'm too restless to be still."
We walked on down toward the river.
"I had to talk to you," she said.
"Well, talk then. Sing, spill."
"Not now," she said soberly,
and looked up at me, and I saw in the light of the street lamp that her face was very serious, even worried. The flesh seemed smoothed back, even painfully taut over the wonderful perfection of the bone structure of her face. There wasn't any waste material in that face, and always there was a hint in it of a trained-down, keyed-up intensity, though an intensity kept under the smooth surface of calm like a flame behind glass. But the intensity was keyed up more than usual, I could see, and I had the feeling that if you turned the wick up a fraction, the glass might crack. I didn't reply, and we took a few more paces. Then she said,
"Later. Now just walk."
So we walked. We had left the streets where the bars and pool rooms and restaurants were, and the blare or whimper of music from beyond the swinging doors. We passed down a grubby dark street where a couple of boys scurried along by the walls of the houses, uttering short, lost-sounding, hollow calls, like marsh birds. The shutters were all closed on these houses, with here and there a tiny chink of light showing, or perhaps the faint sound of voices. Later, in the spring, when the weather turned, people would be sitting out on the sidewalk stoops here in the evenings, talking back and forth, and now and then, if you were a man passing, one of the women would say in a conversational tone, "Hey, bud, you want it?" For this was the edge of the crib section, and some of these houses were cribs. But at this season, at night, whatever kinds of life were in these houses, the good life and the bad life, were still withdrawn deep inside the old husks of damp, crumbling brick or flaking wood. A month from now, in early April, at the time when far away, outside the city, the water hyacinths would be covering every inch of bayou, lagoon, creek, and backwater with a spiritual mauve to obscene purple, violent, vulgar, fleshy, solid, throttling mass of bloom over the black water, and the first heartbreaking misty green, like girlhood dreams, on the old cypresses would have settled down to be leaf and not a damn thing else, and the arm-thick, mud-colored, slime-slick moccasins would heave out of the swamp and try to cross the highway, and your front tire hitting one would give a slight bump and make a sound like kerwhoosh, and a tinny thump when he slapped heavily up against the underside of the fender, and the insects would come boiling out of the swamps, and day and night the whole air would vibrate with them with a sound like an electric fan. And if it was night, the owls back in the swamps would be hooing and moaning like love and death and damnation, or one would sail out of the pitch dark into the rays of your headlights and plunge against the radiator to explode like a ripped feather bolster, and the fields would be deep in that rank, hairy or slick, juicy, sticky grass which the cattle gorge on and never get flesh over their ribs, for that grass is in that black soil, and no matter how far the roots could ever go, if the roots were God knows how deep, there would never be anything but that black, grease-clotted soil, and no stone down there to put calcium into that grass. Well, a month from now, in early April, when all those things would be happening beyond the suburbs, the husks of the old houses in the street where Ann Stanton and I were walking would, if it were evening, crack and spill out onto the stoops and into the street all that life which was now sealed up within. But now the street was blank and dim, with a leaning lamppost at the end of the block, and the cobbles oil-greasy glimmering in its rays, and the houses shuttered, and the whole thing looked like a set for a play. You expected to see the heroine saunter up, lean against a lamppost, and light a cigarette. She didn't come, however, and Ann Stanton and I walked straight through the set, which you knew was cardboard until you put out your hand to touch the damp, furry brick or spongy stucco. We walked on through without talking, perhaps for the reason that if you were in a place like that, which looks like a cardboard stage set and is so damned quaint, whatever you say will sound as though it had been written by some lop-haired, swivel-hip fellow who lived in one of those cardboard houses in an upstairs apartment, overlooking the patio, oh, Jesus, yes, overlooking the patio, and wrote a play for the little theater, which began with the heroine sauntering into a dim street between rows of cardboard houses and leaning against an askew lamppost to light a cigarette. But Ann Stanton was not that heroine, so she didn't lean against the lamppost and didn't say a word, and we kept on walking. We walked on down till we came to the river, where the warehouses were and the docks fingered out into the water. The metal roofs of the docks glimmered dully in the rays of the street lamps. Above the pilings of the docks a thick tangle of mist coiled and drifted, broken here and there to show the sleek, velvety, motionless water, which glimmered darkly like the metal of the roofs or like a seal's black water-slick fur. A few docks down, the stubby masts of freighters were barely visible against the dark sky. Somewhere downstream, a horn was hooting and moaning. We moved along beside the docks, looking out into the river, which was tufted and matted over the blackness with the scraggly, citrus, cottony mist. But the mist stayed close to the surface of the river, and to look out over it made you think of being on a mountain at night and looking for miles out over clouds below. There were a few lights over on the far shore.
This ends Disc 10. All the King's Men, Disc 11.
We came to an open pier, which I remembered as the place where excursion boats picked up their crowds on summer afternoons for the moonlight ride up the river. Big, jostling, yelling, baby-carrying, pop-and-liquor-drinking, sweating crowds. But there wasn't any big sidewheeler there now. White as a wedding cake, cranky and improbable, with red and gilt decorations, and no calliope was playing Dixie and no whistles blowing. The place was as still as a tomb and as blank as Gobi on a moonless night. We walked out to the end of the pier, leaned on the railing, and looked across the river. "All right," I said. She didn't answer. "All right," I repeated. "I thought you wanted to talk."
"It's Adam," she said.
"What about Adam?" I asked evenly.
"You know. You know perfectly well. You went there and..."
"Look here," I said, and I felt my blood getting up and my voice taking on an edge. "I went there and made him a proposition. He's a grown man, and if he doesn't like it, he doesn't have to take it. There's no use blaming me, and..."
"I'm not blaming you," she said.
"You just started to jump me," I said. "But if Adam can't make up his own mind and can't take care of himself, you needn't blame me."
"I'm not blaming you, Jack. You're so jumpy and touchy, Jack."
She laid her hand on my arm on the rail and patted me, and I felt the head of steam in me drop a few pounds of pressure. "If he can't take care of himself, then you..." I began. But she cut in quick and sharp.
"He can't. That's the trouble.
Now look here, all I did was to offer him a proposition." Her hand, which had been laid on my forearm to soothe me and pat down the steam pressure, suddenly clamped on me, driving the fingers damn near to the bone. I jumped, and even as I jumped, I heard her say in a low, tense voice, almost a whisper,
"You can make him take it."
"He's a grown man, and he..." I began, but she cut in again.
"You've got to make him. You've got to."
"For God's sake," I said.
"You've got to,"
she repeated in that same voice, and I was sure that the fingers clenched on my arm were bringing blood. "You were just now giving me hell because I merely offered him the proposition," I said, "and now you say I've got to make him take it?"
"I want him to take it," she said, and her fingers fell away from their grip.
"Well, I'm damned," I observed in the direction of the great interstellar darkness, and then peered into her face. There wasn't much light. I could see the face, an unnatural chalk white, and the eyes were just dark gleams, but I could tell that she meant what she said. "So you want him to take it," I said slowly. "And you're Governor Stanton's daughter and Adam Stanton's sister, and you want him to take it?"
"He's got to," she said,
and I saw her small gloved hands clench on the railing and felt sorry for the railing. She stared out over the coiling carpet of river mist as from the mountain out over the clouds hiding the dark world.
"Why?"
I asked.
"I went up there," she said, still looking out over the river, "to talk to him about it. I wasn't sure he ought to when I went up. I wasn't sure then, but when I saw him, I was."
Something about what she was saying disturbed me, like an offstage noise or something caught out of the tail of your eye or an itch that comes when your hands are full and you can't scratch. I was listening to what she was saying, and it wasn't that. It was something else. But I couldn't catch what. So I shoved it onto the back of the stove and listened to what she was saying.
"When I saw how he was," she was saying, "I knew. I just knew. Oh, Jack, he was all worked up. It wasn't natural, just because he'd been asked. He's cut himself off from everything, from everybody, even from me. Not really, but it's not like it used to be."
He's awful busy, I objected lamely.
Busy, she echoed. Busy, yes, he's busy. Ever since he was in medical school, he's worked like a slave. There's just something driving him. Driving him. It's not money, and it's not reputation, and it's not... I just don't know what.
Her voice drifted off. It's very simple, I said. He wants to do good.
Good, she echoed. Then, I used to think so. Oh, he does good, but...
But what?
Oh, I don't know. And I shouldn't say it. I shouldn't. But I almost think that the work, even the doing good, everything is just a way to cut himself off. Even from me. Even me.
Then she said,
Oh, Jack, we had an awful row. It was awful. I went home and cried all night. You know how we've always been, and to have a terrible row, you know how we've been? You know?
She insisted and clutched my arm as though to make me agree, to make me tell her how they had been. Yes, I said, I know. I looked at her and was afraid for a second she was going to cry again, but she didn't. And I should have known it, for she was the kind that did her crying on the midnight pillow, if she did any.
I told him, she was saying, I told him that if he wanted to do any good, really do any good, here was the time, and the way, to see that the medical center was run right, and even expanded, and all that. But he just froze up and said he wouldn't touch the thing, and I accused him of being selfish and proud, of putting his pride before everything, before doing good, before his duty. Then he just glared at me and grabbed me by the wrist and said I couldn't understand anything, that a man owed himself something. I said it was his pride, just his pride, and he said he was proud not to touch filth, and if I wanted him to do that, I could just...
She stopped, took a breath, and I guessed a new grip on her nerve to say what she was about to say.
Well, what he was going to say was that I could get out.
But he didn't say it.
I'm glad...
She paused again.
I'm glad he didn't say it. At least he didn't say it.
He didn't mean it, I said.
I don't know. I don't know. If you'd seen his eyes blazing and his face all white and drawn. Oh, Jack.
She grabbed my arm again and shook me as though I were holding back an answer.
Why won't he do it? Why is he this way? Doesn't he see he ought to, that he's the man and he's got to? Why, Jack, why?
To be perfectly brutal, I said, it's because he is Adam Stanton, the son of Governor Stanton and the grandson of Judge Peyton Stanton and the great-grandson of General Morgan Stanton, and he's lived all his life in the idea that there was a time, a long time back, when everything was run by high-minded, handsome men, wearing knee breeches and silver buckles, or continental blue, or frock coats, or even buckskin and coonskin caps, as the case may be, for Adam Stanton isn't any snob, who sat around a table and candidly debated the good of the public thing. It's because he's a romantic, and he has a picture of the world in his head, and when the world doesn't conform in any respect to the picture, he wants to throw the world away, even if that means throwing out the baby with the bath, which, I added, it always does mean. That held her for a moment. She turned her face from me and looked out over the misty river again. Then she murmured,
He ought to take it.
Well, I said, if you want him to do it, you've got to change the picture of the world inside his head. If I know Adam Stanton. And I did know Adam Stanton, and at that moment I could see his face with the skin drawn back tight over the bone, and the strong mouth like the neatly healed wound, and the deep-set blue eyes blazing like pale ice. She hadn't answered me. That's the only way, I said, and you might as well settle for that.
He ought to do it,
she whispered, looking over the river. How much do you want him to? She swung to me, and I peered into her face. Then she said,
As much as I want anything.
You mean that? I said.
I mean it. He's got to save himself.
She grabbed my arm again.
For himself, as much as for everybody else, for himself.
Are you sure?
Sure,
she said fiercely. I mean sure that you want him to do it? More than anything?
Yes, she said.
I studied her face. It was a beautiful face. Or, if not beautiful, better than beautiful, a tense, smooth, spare-modeled, finished face, and it was chalk-white in the shadow and the eyes were dark gleams. I studied her face and for the moment just did that and let all the questions just slide away, like something dropped into the mist and water below us to slide away in the oily silence of the current.
"Yes," she repeated, whispering.
But I kept on peering into her face, really looking at it for the first time after all the years, for the close, true look at a thing can only be one snatched outside of time and the questions.
"Yes,"
she whispered and laid her hand on my arm, lightly this time. And at the touch I came out of what I had been sunk in. "All right," I said, shaking myself. "But you don't know what you're asking for."
"It doesn't matter," she said. "Can you make him?"
"I can," I said.
"Well, why didn't you? Why did you wait? Why?"
"I don't think," I said slowly, "I don't think I would have ever done it, at least not this way, if you yourself hadn't asked me."
"How can you do it?"
she demanded, and the fingers closed on my arm. "It's easy," I said. "I can change that picture of the world he carries around in his head."
"How?"
"I can give him a history lesson."
"A history lesson?"
"Yes, I'm a student of history, don't you remember? And what we students of history always learn is that the human being is a very complicated contraption, and that they are not good or bad, but are good and bad, and the good comes out of the bad, and the bad out of good, and the devil take the hindmost. But Adam, he's a scientist, and everything is tidy for him, and one molecule of oxygen always behaves the same way when it gets around two molecules of hydrogen, and a thing is always what it is. And so when Adam, the romantic, makes a picture of the world in his head, it's just like the picture of the world Adam, the scientist, works with. All tidy, all neat. The molecule of good always behaves the same way. The molecule of bad always behaves the same way. There are..."
"Stop it," she ordered. "Stop it and tell me. You're trying not to tell me. You're talking so you won't tell me. Now tell me."
"All right," I said. "You remember I asked you about Judge Irwin being broke? Well, he was. His wife wasn't rich either. He just thought she was, and he took a bribe."
"Judge Irwin?" she echoed. "A bribe?"
"Yes," I said, "and I can prove it."
He was Father's friend. He was..."
She paused, straightened herself, swung her face from me, and looked out over the river. Then, after a moment, in a sturdy voice, as though not to me but to the whole wide world over there beyond the mist,
"Well, that doesn't prove anything, Judge Irwin."
I didn't reply. I, too, stared out over the coiling mist in the dark. I was aware, though I didn't look, when she turned toward me again.
"Well, say something,"
she said, and I heard the tension in her voice. But I didn't say anything. I stood there waiting. And waiting, I could hear, in the silence, the tiny suck and lapping about the piles down in the mist. Then she said,
"Jack, was my father...
I didn't answer.
"You coward," she said. "You coward, you won't tell me."
"Yes," I said.
"Did he take a bribe? Did he? Did he?"
She had grabbed my arm and was shaking me hard. "Not that bad," I said.
"Not that bad. Not that bad," she mimicked, and burst out laughing, hanging on my arm.
Then she suddenly released me, thrust my arm from her as though it were foul, and shrank back.
"I don't believe it,"
she announced. "It's true," I said. "He knew about Irwin and protected him. I can prove it. I have documents." "I'm sorry, but it's true."
"Oh, you're sorry. You're so sorry. You dug it all up, all the lies, for that man, for that Stark, for him and you. You're so sorry."
And she began to laugh again and swung away and was running down the pier, laughing and stumbling as she ran. I ran after her. I was just about to grab her at the end of the pier when the cop stepped out of the shadow of the warehouse and said, "Hey, buddy." Just then, Anne stumbled and I grabbed her by the arm. She swayed in my grasp. The cop approached.
"What's up?" he demanded. "What you running that dame for?"
She's hysterical, I said, talking fast. I'm just trying to take care of her. She's had a few drinks, just a couple, and she's hysterical. She's had a great shock, a grief. The cop, heavy, squat, hairy, took one waddling stride toward us, then leaned and whiffed her breath. She's had a shock, and it has upset her, so she took a drink, and she's hysterical. I'm trying to get her home. His beefy, black-jowled face swung toward me. I'll get you home, he allowed, in a wagon if you ain't careful. He was just talking. I knew he was just talking to hear himself, for it was late and he was bored and dull. I knew that, and should have said, respectfully, that I would be careful, or have said, laughing and perhaps winking, that, sure, Captain, I'd get her home. But I didn't say either thing. I was all keyed up, and she was swaying in my clutch, making a kind of sharp, broken noise with her breathing, and his goddamn beefy, black-jowled face was there in front of me, so I said, "The hell you will." His eyes bugged out a little at that. The jowls swelled with black blood, and he lunged one step closer, fingering his stick, saying, "The hell I won't. I'm gonna right now, both of you, by God." Then he said, "Come on," prodded me with the stick and repeated, "Come on," herding me toward the end of the pier where, no doubt, the box was he would use to call. I took two or three steps forward, feeling the prod of the stick in the small of my back, dragging Anne, who hadn't said a word. Then I remembered, "Listen here, if you want to be on the force in the morning, you better listen to me." "Listen, hell," he rejoined and jabbed my kidney a little harder. "If it weren't for the lady," I said, "I'd let you go on and bust yourself. I don't mind a ride to headquarters, but I'll give you a chance." "Chance," he echoed and spat from the side of his mouth and jabbed again. "I'm going to reach into my pocket," I said, "not for a gun, just for my wallet so I can show you something. Did you ever hear of Willie Stark?" "Sure," he said and jabbed. "You ever hear of Jack Burden?" I asked. "That newspaper fella who is a sort of secretary to Willie?" He reflected a moment, still prodding me on. "Yeah," he said then, grudgingly. "Then maybe you'd like my card," I said, and reached for the wallet. "No, you don't," he said, and let the weight of the stick lie across my lifted forearm. "No, you don't. I'm getting it myself." He reached in for the wallet, took it, and started to open it, as a matter of principle. "You open that," I said, "and I'll bust you anyway, call the wagon or not. Give it here." He passed it over to me. I drew out a card and handed it to him. He studied it in the bad light. "Geez," he said with a slight hissing sound like the air escaping from a child's balloon. "How's I to know you's on the payroll?" "You damn well better find out next time," I said. "Before you get gay, now call me a cab." "Yes, sir," he said, hating me with the pig's eyes out of the swollen face. "Yes, sir," he said and went to the box. Suddenly Anne pulled herself loose from me, and I thought she was going to run. So I grabbed her again. "Oh, you're so wonderful," she said in a harsh whisper. "So wonderful. You're grand. You bully the bullies. You cop the cops. You're wonderful." I stood there holding her, not listening, aware only of a weight in my middle like a cold stone. "You're so wonderful and clean. Everything's so wonderful and clean." I didn't say anything. "You're so damn wonderful and clean and strong. Oh, you're a hero." "I'm sorry I acted like a son of a bitch," I said. "I can't imagine to what particular thing you are referring," she whispered in mock sweetness, underscoring the particular, setting it meticulously in my hide like a banderilla. Then she swung her face from me and wouldn't look at me, and the arm I clutched might as well have belonged to a dummy in a show window, and the cold stone in my stomach was a stone in a deep well covered with slime, and the pig's eyes and the swollen black-jowled face came back, and hated me in the dull, mist-streaked night, and a horn moaned down the river, and in the cab Anne Stanton sat back in one corner, very straight and as far from me as possible, and the light from street lamps we passed would flicker across her white face. She wouldn't speak to me, until we came to a street with a car track on it. Then she said, "Get out. You can catch some car here. I don't want you to take me home." So I got out. 5 nights later, I heard Anne Stanton's voice on the telephone. It said, "Those things, those papers you said you had, send them to me." I said, "I'll bring them." It said, "No,
Send them.
I said, all right. I've got extra photostats of one thing. Tomorrow I'll get a photostat of the other paper and send them together. It said,
a photostat. So you don't trust me?
I said, I'll send them tomorrow.